Curse.
Welcome to Speak and Destroy, episode 74. Speak and Destroy is a podcast featuring interviews about Metallica, and I am your host, Ryan J. Downey. My guest this episode is Skylanders Academy creator Eric Rogers, who tells the story of getting James Hetfield to voice werewolf musician Wolfgang in the hit animated series, which ran for 3 seasons on Netflix. Based on the Activision game series, Skylanders Academy also featured the voice talents of Justin Long, Ashley Tisdale, Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul's Jonathan Banks, Bobcat Goldthwait, and my favorite comedian of all time, Norm Macdonald. Eric talks about working on the Emmy-winning series Futurama, the ups and downs of developing Skylanders Academy, and of course, Metallica. If you'd like to support this podcast, I would like to ask you to go into Apple Podcasts, leave a 5-star rating, and write a nice little review. Like this one from Marty McFly. That's what it says. Great Metallica podcast. Great music podcast. I love hearing how other artists have been influenced by Metallica, but also how Ryan dives into each guest's own music and musical journey. The Jeremiah Scott episode is a great place to start. Thanks, Marty McFly. I agree. It's a pretty good place to start. This review comes from 2-time Speak and Destroy guest, Doc Coyle of Bad Wolves and formerly of the band God Forbid, which says, for the real Metallica fans, I'll pretty much follow anything Ryan Downey does. Same, likewise, back at you, Doc. With Metallica being my favorite band, this is right up my alley. It's just like my friends and I debating Metallica lore amongst ourselves to all hours of the night. You can find me on Twitter at Ryan Downey and on Instagram at SuperheroHQ. You can find Speak and Destroy at speakanddestroy.com, as well as on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. And please subscribe to this podcast as well as the others in the Pop Curse Podcast Network, which includes Pop Curse, Musicians Talking Movies, and No Prize from God, which features conversations with creative people about belief, unbelief, and everything between. So here it is, my conversation with Skylanders Academy creator Eric Rogers. This is Speak and Destroy. You know, and this is by no means an original quote because I took it from somebody else. But, you know, there's that thing about being a writer means having homework every day for the rest of your life.
And yes.
Boy, is that true.
Oh, God, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's such a blessing and a curse because it's like so much fun when you're actually getting paid to actually write the thing. But all the rest of it is such a pain in the ass, you know, the meetings and the thinking of the idea and, you know, if you get a show going, all the bureaucratic garbage that comes with that. So, you know, it's, not to knock any of it. It's just, it's a grind.
Yeah. Everything has its ups and downs, which I think is
people
don't often realize, when it comes to the more, you know, the entertainment world and things like that. So one thing I like to do with every guest is just to talk a little bit about what music was around when you were a kid, kind of what your first encounters were and what art inspired you and that sort of thing. And at what point you made the turn where you knew you had to be more than a fan, you needed to participate in creating the kind of stuff that you loved. Like what that moment was or
right on.
Transition was. So yeah, walk me through that a little bit.
Yeah, these are great questions. So, you know, I grew up in a house that wasn't necessarily very artistic at all, you know, very blue collar. You know, my dad was a big rock and roll fan, you know, he's a child of the 60s. You know, it's funny because I I don't think I appreciated it at the time, but looking back on it, you know, I realized there was a lot of Led Zeppelin played in the house. There was a lot of Rolling Stones, a lot of Ozzy Osbourne, you know, like, so he liked his stuff darker. My mom was kind of like neither here nor there with all of it, but we listened to a lot of pop radio in the car. So I was more of a pop radio kid, in the 80s, you know, so it was more, you know, like my first real like music, appreciation came with Michael Jackson. And, you know, obviously this is when we all thought Michael Jackson was nice and safe and
I don't know what you're referring to.
yeah. This is the Michael Jackson who, you know, who was making these amazing videos, and you know, I you know, you'd watch Thriller, and I wanted to, you know, emulate those dance moves, and you know, I so, and then MTV obviously too. Like, I'm a kid of MTV, a child of MTV.
Me too.
You know, and when MTV hit the air, you know, it was really formative. You know, like, I loved music videos. You know, it's funny, I was thinking a little bit about Metallica before coming into this, and I remember how much I was struck by One and how different that video was at that time for any group, but particularly for a group that sounded like Metallica. You know, like, it was so artistic, and it was so like, it was just, this is next level, you know. And I know I'm like the gazillionth person to say that, but so long-winded story here, like, MTV was really a big deal. And then I kind of became this hip hop kid in high school, and really got immersed in that, like, you know, late 80s, early 90s. Was just really into rap and hip hop. And
an amazing era for that too.
Yeah. I mean, it was a golden age.
Untouchable. Yeah.
Yeah. Really the golden age of hip hop. I think most of it today is garbage, but thank God for, you know, those years. And then it's interesting because I started to ease my way into a little more stuff that was a little harder. And I think hip hop via the Beastie Boys was my bridge from hip hop to like kind of harder edge hip hop with the Beastie Boys and what they did on Check Your Head and what they did on Ill Communication. And then I'm entering college, and I went to school at Miami University, which is in Southwestern Ohio. And they had a indie rock station there called 97X.
I grew up in Indianapolis, and we had, I think it was 91X. We had one of those X stations, the alt rock.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. They all had to have an X, right?
Yeah.
So here I am now in the early 90s, you know, in college, and, you know, now I'm starting to really get into real music, like, not real music, not to say that anything I was talking about before wasn't, but like, bands that are like on the fringe, and like, you know, bands that are up and coming, like, you know, the early days of Pavement and Smashing Pumpkins and Julianna Hatfield and Jeff Buckley, and, you know, like, so really at this point I'm starting to get into that, you know, kind of, you know, looking back on it, it's kind of cliche, but really, like, you know, jumping into the grunge and, you know, just what you know, any kid of the 90s is really immersing themselves into. And, you know, that hard rock grunge stuff really took, you know, stuck to my rib cage too. So, you know, I got into Soundgarden and Nirvana, obviously, and Pearl Jam and Alice in Chains. And, you know, so as I'm sitting here speaking, you know, you can kind of hear that, like, my music tastes have been all over the map. Mm-hmm. And I've been a music fan for my entire life. And now, strangely enough, the stuff that I love most is EDM. Like I love, like, especially like the harder stuff that some of those producers make. So I'm a weirdo, man. Like, I've been,
these are the people I connect with though. And I think it might be emblematic of our Generation X-ness that we have this sort of, we're like the iPod shuffle people, you know, even though that came later for us, but that a lot of my friends, it's like, we've gone through phases, right? Where, you know, I was really into punk and new wave as a kid, and then I right into thrash metal, and all through seventh, eighth, ninth grade, I was denim jacket, long hair, patches, all that. And then it was punk and hardcore. And then, yeah. you know, in my 20s, there was a period where it's all about Britpop, and I had like Liam Gallagher haircut, and everything was Pulp and Blur and Oasis, and
then
there's hip hop, right? That same stuff that you were talking about, that same era that was big for me. And I think that it, as much of a hodgepodge and kind of a quilt as it seems like, I think that it's made us more well-rounded people.
Yeah,
because I mean, even when you think about, like, you know, a lot of stuff that's happening with like woke culture right now, it's like, dude, I was 14 listening to X-Clan and KRS-One, and you know, a lot of these ideas that are getting into popular culture now are not new. And, and for those of us who were more on the fringes, experiencing things through,
I was just, you know, same way, dude. I mean, I it's so funny. I'm like a 15-year-old kid listening to Public Enemy. Like, I like Fear of a Black Planet was massive for me, you know? And, you know, I'm this dopey, cheesy white kid from, you know, Middletown, Ohio, walking around, you know, spitting the lyrics to Welcome to the Terror Dome, you know? And and I don't know necessarily what I'm saying when I'm you know, rhyming these songs, but all I know is, and this is, I think this is why music and art is so amazing. Like, all I know is how it made me feel while I was sitting, you know, driving around in my car, you know, listening to that song and rhyming along with it, or rhyming along to like Mama Said Knock You Out, or, you know, any of Tribe Called Quest stuff. And it's, you know, as you get older and you get some wisdom and you look back on, you know, what you actually were into, you're like, oh, you know, what they're talking about means something way different to other people than what it meant for me. And maybe I should take a second and reflect a little bit on what Public Enemy or KRS-One or, you know, MC Light or any of those awesome, you know, MCs were talking about in these songs, as opposed to just the way it made me feel. But, you know, at the end of the day, that is why music is amazing. It's like, it could be how it makes you feel. And then if you get that extra bonus of, this is about something, this is not just pop to make you feel good. It's just icing on the cake. So, I love that we're talking music, man. I don't get a chance to do this often.
I figured that would be part of the fun of the invitation. And I try to have conversations like this. Yeah. Where we get to, musicians talking movies and movie people talking music and stuff that I love.
That's awesome, man.
Yeah. I find that I also respond to art and music that has something to say, and that doesn't have to be political, spiritual. It doesn't have to be like a specific, you know, tradition that they're pushing on you, but just that it has a meaning behind it, where you get the sense that if this person wasn't creating that art, that they'd be, you know, dead or in jail or something, you know. That it's like, this is the thing that they have to do. And I would certainly put the same passion into film and TV and animation and a bunch of stuff that has been part of your life and your career. Where did that stuff enter into? What's kind of the origin story of you getting to do that professionally?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, just kind of circling back to one of your original questions, you know, when did this become a thing that I knew I was going to pursue as opposed to like a hobby? And I kind of knew in high school that I hate though using the word gift because it sounds so pretentious, but it was a gift. And, you know, I had a teacher that, you know, I had written a story for him, and it was kind of this overwrought and diehard knockoff.
That was a whole subgenre where you had like diehard in a hockey rink with Van Damme and diehard on a ship with Seagal. And it was a whole, needs to do a program, a festival that's just diehard in a blank and just show all 10 of those movies.
Right. I would shut up and take my money. That was
exactly. Me too.
But I mean, I had this teacher that you know, took me aside, and he said, hey, you know, this is something that you're really good at, and I think you should keep going with it. And, you know, I always loved the process of writing. You know, I think that is, you know, as much as, you know, when anybody ever asks me, you know, like, what are the important parts of what's important about pursuing this as a career? And it's not that you just want to tell stories and you have a good story in your head, but you have to love the grind. You have to love the discipline of it. That is what writing is, because it is committing yourself to sitting down in front of a pad of paper or your laptop every day and putting that stuff down and really going from A to Z as far as, you know, completing something. So I always love that part of the process. So I met in my senior year of high school, my mom worked for a guy whose daughter was a writer on China Beach out here in LA. And I met her and she told me about how she had this career as a TV writer. And like, then I had stars in my eyes. I was like, TV yeah. writer, what the, that sounds amazing, right?
Yeah, like that's possible? Like people do that? Yeah.
That was really it. Yeah. Like I never thought, you know, in all of our time growing up and watching television, that there was actually people sitting in a room writing scripts and you know, getting right. paid to do it. I just, you know, just loved what I was watching.
A writer's room? You mean just like exactly. hanging out with 10 yeah. other me's?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So she, I told her, I said, that sounds amazing. How does one do this? And she said, look, you know, go to college, get your degree. When you get to your senior year, if this is something that is still, if you're still passionate about, please give me a shout. So I got to my senior year. I had bounced around with majors. I had, you know, been an education major at one point, thinking I was going to be a teacher. I was a lit major, and I stayed a lit major, but I also threw the creative writing major onto it because I was like, I want to write. I got to do this. And I ended up writing her a letter my senior year of college saying, hey, I really want to come to LA and give this a shot. She wrote me back with her phone number. She said, when you get here, give me a shout. And if I can help you, I will help you. So August of 1995, I throw all my stuff into my car. Me and a buddy drive out here. I let her know I'm here. And 2 weeks later, I had my first job in the industry. She, wow. I had lucked out. I had lucked out in the sense that she was on a show for Stephen Bochco called Murder One. And a PA position had just come open because the kid who was doing the job had a mental breakdown or something. So there was this wide open job and she slipped me into it. And from then on, it was, you know, I was in the TV industry. And great thing about being a PA is that, and you know, if you know all this, you know, I apologize.
I love hearing it. And okay. regardless of whatever I know, people listening don't know or do.
Yeah, great. Yeah.
Keep going.
So, yeah. you know, part of being a PA is that you get to see what everybody on a show, what all their jobs are, you know, from mm-hmm. the art department to the writing to the producers, directors, you know, the craft service dude. And if you want to work in television, you really get that bird's eye view of this is what everyone does. So, you know, I took all that in. I was like, yeah, I still want to be a writer. I think, you know, I was like, this is so the grind. Like, and TV writing is really more of the blue collar writing of our industry because it really is that 9 to 5 or, you know, not 9 to 5, more like 10 to 8 job where you are working all day, Monday through Friday and some weekends. And I love that. You know, I guess that's the blue collar in me, mm-hmm, my background where I was like, you yeah. know, I like working. I like doing stuff during the day and not wasting my time. So, mm-hmm. you know, the TV writing thing really was the jam for me. So I was working on a couple of years for Bochco. Then one of the shows I was on got canceled. And I caught another super lucky break in my career because I was unemployed for about 6 months. And I thought, you know, okay, this isn't working out now. I should throw in the towel. And
I was going to say that those are those moments where it's really easy to go, well, I guess that was that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's where it was. And I started going down the path of, okay, I'm going to teach, you know, I guess this is, you know, this other stuff's not working out. And somebody from 20th Century Fox gives me a call. And says, hey, we got your resume here. And the funny thing was, is I don't know how they got my resume. I don't know how they got my resume. It's a crazy set of circumstances, but they say to me on the phone, Matt Groening, you know who that guy is? he's got a new show. And I'm like, yeah, I know who Matt Groening is. You know, the guy, the Simpsons, the house that built Fox. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
And then they say, yeah, he's
theme,
doing
theme song from the guy from Oingo Boingo. Yeah.
Have you ever heard of David Bowie? Yeah, so they say, yeah, he's got this new show. It's starting right now. Mm-hmm. There's only a pilot script written in, and they need a writer's assistant, and that was Futurama. And I went in for that job, and you know, I had no hope that I was going to get this job, because at this point in my time, I was like just this shitty like alt kid who like was wearing like secondhand clothes from like the consignment shops. You know, mm-hmm. it was totally that Beastie Boys thing where like, yeah, I'm just going to go buy big shirts and wear Pumas and baggy pants.
Yeah. I'm gonna get a shirt from the thrift store that's for like a gas station in Kansas that went out of business 10 years ago.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, yeah, this chicken place, you know, I never went there, but I know it was really awesome, you know. You know, and I had blonde hair, dude. I have that, like the Eminem look at this point. Mm-hmm. And like that's like the shirt I went in for my interview was like this shitty collar, like 70s looking thing. Like I was such an idiot, but I got the job. And so really at that point, you know, here I am now in the writer's room of Futurama, which is like, you know, basically being on The Simpsons. Yeah. Cause all those guys had just came from The Simpsons to do this. And that was my first exposure to comedy writing and animation. And at that point, really, it was just like, yes, this is where I want to be. You know, I worked for, let's see, the first two and a half seasons of the show. I got my first writing credit at the end of season two. I got to co-write an episode with David Cohen and Ken Keeler. And then from there, I started writing comic books for Matt's comic book company, The Simpsons mm-hmm. Comics and Futurama Comics. And then really, at that point, it was animation was the thing I was doing. So I spent.
But were the comic books canon?
Well, it's so funny because I took it so seriously too. I was, you know, especially with Futurama. Like Futurama, I had this like real like ownership of, you know, because we were there. We were there from day one. Mm-hmm. And whenever I proposed my stories to the editor and, or, you know, any of that sort of thing, I always felt like I wanted, if this were different, it could be an episode of the show. I wanted mm-hmm. it to be that good. And I always approached it with that sort of serious attitude. So, yeah. Yes, I would hope that in some way, somebody would look at those stories and go, yeah, this totally fits into the Futurama canon. But at that point, yeah, I mean, I was doing animation. I worked on after Futurama ended. I went away from the show for a bit and then came back with the show when it was on the Comedy Central run in 2009 to 2013. That is when I got promoted full time as a writer, so staff writer finally. That really set my career rolling along. After Futurama ended, I bounced around on a few shows. I was on Brickleberry for a second. Mm-hmm. Did a bunch of freelance for kids shows like Littlest Pet Shop and Wander Over Yonder and Kick Patowski and that sort of thing. And then got another really great break in my career when my agent got a call saying that the Activision was trying to turn the Skylanders video game into a show. And mm-hmm. would they have a writer who has a take on it? My agent was like, yeah, my guy should come in and pitch his take. So I did that and they liked my take on the story. So I got to become the creator and EP of the Skylanders Academy show. You know, that was so amazing. And, you know, to be finally be, you know, mostly in charge. I wasn't all the way in charge mm-hmm. of that show, but, you know, I got to learn how to be a showrunner on the fly and, you know, obviously work with all this amazing talent, you know, which has brought us to this, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's my history in sort of a nutshell.
Well, you know, I love it. Thank you. That's exactly what I was looking for. And, you know, what's great is that, you know, as we're talking about, you know, being Generation X, being from the Midwest, being blue collar, all these things we have in common, that I know you'll relate to this, which is that, as I'm a parent now and just knowing that there are people that are like one of us that are out there behind the scenes creating stuff, you can just feel it. It's visceral, you know, in the way that I remember being so offended as a kid, talking elementary age. Mm-hmm. I could tell very early on when something was dumbed down, and I really resented, you know, Saturday morning cartoons, whatever it was that was pandering, that was patronizing. Yep. You know, it was probably a bit precocious of me, but I'd be offended by it, you know? And then, mm-hmm. and then, so when something did cut through the noise that was, you know, I always had the attitude that if you make it for a little bit older audience, the younger audience is going to aspire to rise up to a level to understand versus constantly dumbing things down and going downwards. And this was something that, you know, in my own career, when I became a reporter and a writer for MTV News, there'd be this culture clash of people in management who felt that you should write towards 15-year-olds. And mm-hmm. then people in management, you know, Tom Freston, who was a big figure at MTV, and I was lucky enough to hear, I went to he gave like a town hall for employees that I went to, and I'm going, why can't I drag everyone else from my department in to hear this? But he said something that someone got up and asked a question, and part of the way she phrased the question, she said, you know, the 15-year-olds who watch our channel, and regardless of whatever her question was, he cut her off and he said, don't say that. I hate hearing that. He's like, first of all, the median age of our viewership is 18 to 21. And secondly, the 15-year-olds who watch the channel want to be the 21-year-olds.
Yeah.
Right to the 21-year-olds, not to the 15-year-olds. And that's how you'll get the 15-year-olds. And it just felt so validating because that was all the way back to cartoons as a kid. That was something that I connected with, you know, and reading you know, Chris Claremont and John Byrne, X-Men comics. And
oh yeah, for sure.
You know, I'm in fifth grade reading that stuff. And there are things that were maybe not appropriate that went over my head, which that's something that I'm trying to remember as a parent too, where it's like, why I didn't, you know, when you see Jean Grey dressed up as the Black Queen in the Hellfire Club, I didn't make any of those connections to what that was all, you know, I read it now and I'm like, wow, I read that when I was 11. So anyway, all of which is a long-winded way of saying that as a parent and as an adult, I appreciate so much shows like Skylanders where no one's talking down to the kids, you know, it's fun and it's appropriate and all of that, but it's smarter and you can always hear that behind the scenes and what brings us to us having this conversation is that, before we even get to James Hetfield, My son, who's 7 now, was watching Skylanders and we're, you know, binging through it and watching episodes multiple times. And, you know, I'm 46, so I recognize Bobcat. Bobcat. Awesome. You know, and also, you know, when you think about how, I mean, I loved him, obviously Police Academy, but I loved his stand up. I loved One Crazy Summer or something I watched again just recently. It's crazy stories about, you know, him opening for Nirvana, you know, setting the couch on fire on the Tonight Show, all that great stuff that I associate with Bobcat. And it's such a joy when you hear somebody like that, who is so subversive and is so provocative and cool and smart on a kid's show. It was the same feeling I had, hearing Gilbert Gottfried in Aladdin, you know, where it's just like,
Well, it's funny too, because, you know, we did a fair amount, as you know, we did a fair amount of stunt casting with the show, you know, but there were, you know, Bobcat was an easy one because Bobcat did Pop in the video game. Mm-hmm. And when I heard Pop, when I found that out and I heard his performance in the game, I was like, it has to be Bobcat. Like we can't change this role, you know, you know, and then like, hearing that Norm MacDonald was down to be Glumshanks, I was like, yes, of course. You know, I grew up watching
my number one absolute favorite all-time stand-up. I mean, you know, I love Carlin, I love Pryor, I love all the greats. Norm MacDonald is my number one living or dead stand-up comedian.
And I loved him on, you know, we grew up watching him on Saturday Night Live on the news desk, you know, and he, you know, and like, without getting too inside baseball, for all the ups and downs of the production, you know, the best moments I take away from being a part of the show and having the privilege of, you know, creating it and running it was having the getting to meet those guys, you know, getting to work with Catherine O'Hara, who, you know, and when we start recording the show, she's like, yeah, I'm doing this new show up in Canada called Schitt's Creek, you know, who knows if it'll last. And you're like, what? You know, six years later, you're like, holy crap, dude, she's she was talking about that.
Yeah.
You know, doing our stupid little show, you know, but like,
yeah.
And then like meeting Bobcat, who is, by the way, like we have, especially our generation, we have this image of this dude who's just going to walk in the room and be like, ah, and be bananas.
The
and,
persona. You know, yeah.
And he's so chill. Like you might not even look twice at him on the street because he keeps to himself. He's definitely one of the turn the switch on for the performance and then turn it off again kind of guys. Extremely nice. Like but you know, again, hearkening back to, you know, our generation, it was so cool to like go, oh my God, I watched you on Police Academy and I love One Crazy Summer. And,
yeah.
You know, like, and to now have you like across the glass in the booth, you know, performing this wacky character is just, you know, it's fun to talk about again, because it reminds me of, you know, how much fun that actually
the upside was, as opposed to the drag of behind the scenes.
Yeah.
Yeah. What can you tell me about Norm? He's, like I said, he's my number one, and him, speaking of disruption and provocation, one of the things I appreciate even more now is his Weekend Update turn, because him and Jim Downey, no relation, the writer that he did most of those jokes with.
Yes, right.
Their whole thing was like, they weren't trying to get laughs, which sounds so counterintuitive, but like, they were just as excited to bum out the audience or to have an awkward silence. Oh, so smart. And, and that's something that, you know, persistent his work. And again, it's so great to hear his voice on a kids show. Knowing that there's that, you know, subversiveness, but also he's like, I saw him once described as a combination of an old man and a young kid. And it's like so perfect, you know? So yeah, anyway, that's sorry. Awesome. I could talk about
Norm forever, no, absolutely, man. Like he's really nice as well. Like just, what can I tell you about? Is there anything really that stuck out about him? Not really. Other than just that just really chill, droll demeanor of his, you know, and he also was a guy that, you know, obviously he's different than Bobcat as a performer, but he never really went out of his way to be funny man when he wasn't in the booth doing his thing. You know, he you wouldn't even know probably if you probably wouldn't realize he was a stand up or a comedian in any sense if you didn't have that history of him. So, but it was, you know, great to have him on the show as well. And, you know, it was one of those things where when we made our list of who we wanted to play what, you know, Norm's name for Glumshanks was pretty much the top of the list, because you look at that character's design and you go, what does that guy sound like? And then you think of Norm and you go, oh gosh, if we can get Norm to do it. And, you know, lo and behold, we did. So it was just really, really fortunate.
Oh yeah. So cool. And then of course, you know, and back to this theme of disruptors, you know, Metallica very, very famously refused to cater to radio, refused to even make a video for MTV. And then when they finally made a video, it was this, you know, dialogue and darkness and literary, you know, cinephile, all this, you know, incredible in that sense. And it's easy to forget in the hugeness of what the band has become,
right?
How punk rock that was in that moment.
Absolutely,
you know?
Absolutely. Especially in the 80s, when, you know, every band wanted to be on MTV, and especially the, you know, not the Metallica, because they were a hair band anyway.
But that was huge then.
Yeah.
Yeah. Have chicks in your video and fast cars and, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. It was, to harken back to talking about one at the beginning of this, man, like just what a punch in the throat to the rest of the industry to go, okay, well, you can make your, you know, Whitesnake style videos, and we're gonna do this thing that's just gonna make people think and you know, maybe win us some awards.
Yeah, the antithesis of you know, the sweet cherry pie video. You know, like, how can we make exactly not that? Oh, that's bright and colorful. This is blue and gray.
Exactly right.
Yeah, that was the stuff that really, really, as you said, stuck to my ribs back then. Right on, so, man. Yeah. So of course, Papa Het getting James Hetfield in the mix for Skylanders. How is that thought about? How is that conceived? And then how does that executed to where it's actually pulled off?
I got to tell you, man, it was pretty simple. We made a list for each character that we knew that we wanted to have on the show. So, you know, we came up with the idea that, you know, the villains, were going to be like this Legion of Doom at some point, for the series. And, you know, it's going to be this kind of slow rollout of, you know, this episode is going to be this person that we meet. This person is going to be this episode that we meet and fight. But by the end of season one, they'll all have had had an encounter with our heroes, and they'll come together around Chaos and be like, "Yeah, if we all work together, then we can defeat these, you know, two goody two shoe heroes." So, they gave us not sort of a blank slate of you can pick whoever you want, but there were in doing our research, you know, there were certain villains from the game that were more popular than others, and and Wolfgang, you know, definitely was a character in not only look but the origin that like just really jumped out, and we were like, that guy, you know, it would be badass to have, you know, that character, because he looks like he's just a gritty rock star, you know, like, and, you know, like, what if we, you know, and part of the fun of, you know, doing Skylanders and in my history, doing other shows, were based on IP where they, you know, don't necessarily have a lot of backstory for the characters. You know, part of the fun is to look at the character and go, who is that guy? Who is that gal? You know, where did they come from? And so when I was looking at Wolfgang, I was like,
not to interrupt you, but it's like Star Wars, right? When there were these characters that were just background, that was just some, you know, Wolfman costume or whatever. And then, you know, for decades now, there's been all these creative people coming in and going, I'm going to, you know, here's a novel about that guy with the devil face in the cantina.
Yeah, like everybody in the cantina, you're like, what, where did they come from? Like, you could create, like you said, novels. Like, you could write novels, like so many stories about just those characters. So with Wolfgang, it was like, I became like kind of obsessed with this idea that he's a failed rock star, and you know, his evil came from, you know, his failure, you know, and he had, like, so it was a very kind of pure place that he was coming from in his wanting to seek revenge on, you know, the people that were successful in the Skylands. So now we got this character that we know we can use. So I'm thinking to myself, well, who sounds like a werewolf, you know, and who would actually, of all the successful rock and rollers and rock stars that are out there, who would be a guy that like would be a really nice fit? And Hetfield was at the top of my list. Like, you know, like, and it's not like I'm the biggest Metallica fan of all time, but I'm big enough to know, like, you know, he is a guy that like I've always admired who they are, what they do, and their success. And there's just that growl that he has when he sings. And so it was, so when I proposed it, I was like, what if we got James Hetfield? Because not only does the guy have this, not really a rock and roll star, but he has this growling, you know, angry voice.
That grittiness,
That grittiness. And also, we have the opportunity, and the show kind of dropped the ball on this, but we have the opportunity to have that guy promote the show into his universe, which is not kids television, you know, like to have that guy be able to go out and go, hey, I'm on Skylanders and you guys should watch. And Activision, man, I won't get into it. It's funny with the promotion of the show, especially season one, like just nobody, like I don't blame any of our actors or talent. I just feel like Activision did not put an emphasis on saying, hey, go and promote this show for us. We didn't, even the leads of the show, you know, Justin Long and Gosh, I'm drawing blanks here. Justin Long. We have Justin and Ashley. Ashley did promoted the show. There was one more I'm forgetting. Oh, Jonathan Banks from that Breaking Bad. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
None of them except for Ashley did any PR for it. Wow. So you know if we
can. Yeah, I mean, leader, yeah, and I'm also thinking Felicia Day and Jason Ritter was in there.
So they were, you know, they came aboard later in season, or they came aboard in season two and kind of stuck around later. And then it was at that point that like there was a little more promotion done on their end, but like the show had already been in, like it was going into season three and they knew they weren't going to pick it up for another season. So it was like too little too late. Like you really need that star power to come out firing from day one. So that way everybody's talking about the show and it's on everyone's radar, and it just didn't happen. So,
well, and to your point, I mean, I am a huge stand-up fan. And so of course, you know, Norm, Bobcat, Reese Darby, you know, and I'm such a Metallica fan that I host this Metallica podcast, interviews about Metallica. I wasn't aware that James Hetfield was in the show until I was on the couch with my son and heard the voice and went, "Is that James Hetfield?"
Right.
And then you wait for the credits and you're like, "Yes, it was."
Well, yeah, and, so. and part of the problem too, dude, is that, you know, animation takes so long to make from start to finish. And there was a bit of a gag order on us to not talk about the show until it actually was about to air. And that I think is a mistake. I think, you know, you without violating, you know, too much NDA territory and giving too much away, I think that we should be able to say, hey, we're doing a show. I'm not gonna tell you too much, but look at this picture of me and James Hetfield.
I was just about to say, if I had seen video of Hetfield in the booth without even knowing what the show was or what, you know, what character, how involved he was, like I would have been,
Absolutely. Yes. We would have had a whole different fan base that would not have been brought to the table otherwise. Because like you, dude, there's Metallica fans with kids who want to watch this.
Exactly.
You know? I'm not expecting your 6-year-old or my 7-year-old to know who the hell they are. But at the same time, you know, he's got kids. Hetfield has kids, you know, and it's like, and we just, there was this weird sort of preciousness about like not allowing anything out until the show was actually premiered on Netflix. And then it was like, but now the show's been dumped. Like it's all the episodes are out. Like it doesn't make any sense
to try to promote each episode and each guest. And
especially
in the things are consumed now.
Exactly right. So, you know, there were mistakes made.
Well,
you know, and I only got them. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No. I was going to say, on a positive note, as a fan of animation, also I love that the show, you got to work with Dee Bradley Baker and Billy West, who are both like those are almost like good luck charms for your cartoon, right?
Well, like. And I'll tell you some. This is a little more inside baseball. So, you know, coming from Futurama, you know, our main cast, you know, 5-6 actors, all did the voices. Like, you know, we didn't go. We never really dipped our toes outside of that cast when it came to doing all the different voices. So when it came time to do Skylanders, I wasn't the biggest fan of stunt casting. You know, like with a role like Wolfgang, you know, that is a specific look and voice that you want to get somebody like James Hetfield in for. But for like our leads, you know, you look at Spyro the Dragon, like, does that have to be Justin Long? can't that be Jason Ritter coming off of Gravity Falls? You know, like can't it be? So I was a big fan of like, let's use a bunch of tried and true VO pros for our main cast and I was overruled. And you know, we went out and got some bigger names, and you know, it really is very educational. It's a very educational process, because you're like, you can go out and get Susan Sarandon to play a villain in your show, but if she doesn't give a shit, then and she's not going to use her clout as an Oscar winner, as a movie star that everybody knows, to promote this thing, then who cares? You know what I mean? You can get Parker Posey. people know who Parker Posey is, but Parker Posey is not going to promote the show. If Justin Long is not going to promote the show, then is it worth stunt casting for? And that's where I defaulted. You know, I was always like, let's get the actors who love these jobs and who just want to do this.
Rob Paulsons of the world. And yeah. And these utility and people that come in and do three or four different characters.
I tried to get John DiMaggio a lead on the show. I wanted him as a Ruptor. John DiMaggio, a freaking vendor.
Yeah.
They said he wasn't big enough name to be one of our leads. And I was like, okay. Mm. And God, John is such a good dude. He came in and he played a different role for us, a smaller role, but that was him just being a good dude and us having a relationship. But I always like that always bummed me out that like I couldn't bring in who I knew was a rock star in the VO world to play these roles, and that I didn't get trusted on that, you know? So,
and you know, that's kind of, I think, and again, inside baseball, right? But I think it goes back to maybe Shrek, but there were certain films where once, you know, audiences, once there was an expectation of like, oh, I want to hear Brad Pitt doing the voice. Because it was like up until a certain moment, you know, there weren't A-list actors voicing the Little Mermaid or Beauty and the Beast, or, you know, those were like cartoon actors, you know, voiceover artists, you know?
Yeah. The real turning point was Robin Williams in Aladdin.
Oh, I think sure.
Robin Williams plays the genie. And I think at that point, everybody goes, oh, holy moly, movie stars will do this. And not only that, but like, we can get them, we pay them enough, we can fill out a cast with them. And movies are a different beast. Like I don't begrudge stunt casting so hard, especially with these bigger movie projects. You know, like I understand getting Steve Carell to play the bad guy in Minions. Sure. You know, I especially when it comes to the comedic actors, you know, I like guys whose voices are you know, the guys who have that comic timing, guys and gals, I should say, not just guys, but like, you know, whose voices just like totally lend themselves to being zany characters. I get it. I totally get it. But when you're making a kid's show and you're going to be on Netflix and it's going to be a binged product, at the end of the day, a kid doesn't care. You know, your sweet spot audience doesn't give a damn about Susan Sarandon. They don't know who that is, you know?
Yeah.
You know, it needs to be more about finding the right great person for the role as opposed to going, oh, that's a name, here's a bunch of money, do our show. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I learned those lessons with doing Skylanders, and, you know, it's a mistake I aim not to make again. And, you know, with the show that I did a series for Hasbro, which hasn't been announced yet. But I was steadfast in, you know, we stunt cast a little bit on the show, but I was really hardline about like, okay, we can put this person in this, and this person in that, but I want these other rock and roll VO actors in this show because those are the people that we can absolutely depend on too.
You can depend on them, and they're. You know, why take food off of their table? Because that's a whole culture.
Right.
That's a specific
great point too.
Art, yep. You know, and why? Yep. I mean, you know, it's like casting. I mean, musicians and rappers sometimes are also stunt casting, and it's like, well, couldn't you just have somebody who's a trained actor with experience in that role? Which isn't to say that there aren't people who are multi-talented and can do it all. But
absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I really got a crash course in this about 10, 15 years ago. I did, I produced bonus features for Lionsgate for some Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle DVD sets from the 80s series. And so in the process of doing that, you know, I interviewed the voice actors for all four turtles and the late James Avery who did Shredder. And
oh, right. Yeah.
And just meeting all of those voice actors. That's when I really started to learn about this kind of the downside of putting A-list movie stars in voice acting roles. So
it's a slippery slope.
Yeah, indeed. And there's the obvious upside. Well, Hasbro, without making you spoil anything, I mean, I'm thinking Hasbro, I'm thinking obviously G.I. Joe and Transformers, but there's Micronauts, There was Rom Space Knight, which Rom Space Knight got me into comic books.
Yep.
That was literally the first comic that I ever bought and started collecting. And then the X-Men and Spider-Man and other Marvel characters showing up in Rom is how I broadened out into the Marvel universe.
That's fantastic, yeah.
But yeah, there's a lot of cool stuff at Hasbro. So
And
Hasbro bought E1 Records, which bought Death Row Records. So if you ever want to make that Suge Knight cartoon.
that Suge Knight cartoon that all the kids are clamoring for.
Yeah, exactly.
So the adventures of Lil Suge and Dr. Dre, right?
Yeah, those would be great action figures. I can see the merch line at Target. It's be great.
It's funny you mentioned Micronauts. Just sitting right here, right below me here, I have a bunch of old Micronauts comics that I bought in bulk and have been plowing through. So neither here nor there.
Just as a completely unrelated thread. Well, you know, I like to think of these podcast episodes as evergreen. So if someone's listening to this 2 years from now, they're going to be like, "Oh, how coy!" But
they were so clever.
Well, dude, I love it so much. Thank you so much for making the time to do this. Let's definitely stay in touch. We've obviously got a lot.
Dude, absolutely.